KEXP thanks contributing donors and the Real Networks Foundation for supporting Mind Over Matters.
This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Robert Engelman, Vice President for Programs at World Watch Institute and author of the book More: Population, Nature, and What Women Want. Formerly a newspaper reporter covering politics, health, science, and the environment, Robert has served on the faculty of Yale University, and his work has appeared in a variety of publications, including Nature, The Washington Post, and The Wall Street Journal. Robert Engelman is here today to tell us about population, climate change, and women's lives, the topic of a recent World Watch report. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you very much, Diane.
What is the goal of your report, Population, Climate Change, and Women's Lives?
What I'd like to do is bring population into the climate debate in a respectable way that could make a positive contribution to addressing climate change. And in order to do that, I think one needs to present population as an issue of public concern that need not be seen as something dreadful or too sensitive to talk about or requiring population control, which is something not many people are very excited about, but actually relates more directly to something that is in fact very positive, namely improving women's lives and giving women more capacity to manage their own lives and control their own reproduction and the productive aspects of their lives.
What are the current trends in population worldwide? Where do we currently stand in 2011?
Well, that's a good question to ask, particularly in 2011, because we're about to celebrate a big number. If celebration is the word, and people can judge for themselves on that, but it seems very likely that before the year is out, this year, 2011, we will have 7 billion people on the planet for the first time in our history. And that's a remarkable number when you consider that it took until about 1800 or so, or a little after 1800, to get to the very first billion in human population. All of the species history from 200,000 years or so ago when we first separated off from other human-like species to sometime after 1800 to reach 1 billion. By 1900, we were at about 1.6 billion. And then about the middle of the century, especially after World War II, when public health interventions all over the world made it much more likely that babies would survive to their own adulthood, the numbers started going up rather dramatically to literally an added billion almost every 12 to 15 years or so, so that we had 2.5 billion by the end of World War II. We had 3 billion by the early 60s. 4 billion sometime in the 70s, 5 billion, I remember because I covered the day of 5 billion as a reporter in the late 80s, 6 billion at the end of the 90s, and 7 billion this year. So in a sense, the numbers are going up in a completely unprecedented way. The world has no experience with this many people. The Earth itself has no experience with it. The species we live with and who are our companions, our only known companions in the universe, have no experience with this. So from that perspective, it really is unprecedented. There's another way to look at it, though, which is a little bit more positive, which is that the growth itself is actually slowing down globally. It was at its fastest on an annual basis in the late 60s and early 70s. Humanity was literally growing at almost 2% a year. That doesn't sound like a whole lot from when you think of economic growth, but from the standpoint of having an additional 40, 50, 60, 70, and now it's almost 80 million people a year, new people every year, it has a major impact on the planet. But the growth rate has been cut in about half, and the average human family is about half the size that it was in the late 60s and early 70s. This is happening very unevenly, some places so dramatically that governments are worried about population declining. That's happening in Japan and Germany and several other countries, not many, but several. But the dominant phenomenon is still population growth. In some countries, quite rapid, in sub-Saharan Africa, parts of Western Asia, South Asia to some extent, the Philippines, there's still pretty rapid population growth. And as a bottom line, what I think can be said is that every day there's about 215,000 more people who are effectively, as my friend and mentor Lester Brown likes to say, at the dinner table waiting for their food. So it's still predominantly a message of growth. In that sense, we set records every day for the human presence on the planet.
What are the current projections for world population in 2050?
Well, they generally center around 9 billion people. Their projections aren't well understood. There's a lot of thinking, even among experts, that demographers know exactly what's happening in human population, and there will be 9 billion people up from today's almost 7. by 2050. But really, demographers don't know. They don't really know what fertility will be, that is, how many children women will be having on average over the next 20 or 30 or 40 years. They don't really know where death rates will go, although they assume that they'll continue improving because they've been improving for quite some time. So they kind of make their best guess based on current trends, and they usually have several scenarios, and generally only the medium scenario, the one kind of just in the middle, gets any attention. But there really are a range of scenarios, and the demographers of the United Nations, the ones I use in my own research work, and I think the ones who are most commonly referred to around the world, it's called the UN Population Division. The demographers there have three main projections, the low, medium, and high, and they project anywhere from around 8 billion on the low side to 9 billion plus, about 9.1 or 2 billion on the medium side, and closer to 10 billion on the high side in 2050. But, of course, 2050 isn't the end of time. Things will still be changing in 2050, and increasingly, as we get closer to 2050, people in climate change and in other areas want to know what's going to happen in 2100 or even 22 or 2300. And there things get very, very hard to know. The further you go into the future, the harder it is to predict what's likely to happen. But it's important to note that when demographers say, well, we'll have about 9 billion people in the middle of the century, that doesn't mean that it stops at 9 billion. It's like carbon dioxide, when it's going to double. It might do more than double. It might triple or quadruple. And in the case of population, the key thing we really do not know is when it stops growing and what is its peak. And then presumably it will subside at some point, but nobody really knows when that will be. And the median projection is that we have about 9.1 billion people in 2050, but it's still growing by 26 or 27 million people every year. So there really isn't a standard prediction for where world population growth actually stops. And even the predictions that are made are sort of conditional predictions on women having access to good contraceptive services, so that almost all, or at least the average woman in the world, can have about 2 children per woman by 2050. Well, it turns out that there's no certainty that that will happen. We're not actually on a trend right now to provide good contraceptive family planning services to women all around the world by 2050. So there's actually just really a lot of uncertainty, and it's kind of a private passion of mine, but projections get a little bit more attention than they deserve, and people think that, you know, the demographers say this will happen, therefore this will happen. We don't know what will happen in the future. It hasn't happened yet.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Robert Engelman, Vice President for Programs at World Watch Institute and author of the World Watch Report, Population, Climate Change, and Women's Lives. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. To what extent is population driving climate change?
Well, over the long term, historically, it is a major, major driver, and for a fairly simple reason, and I think it's evident in the numbers that I've just been probably overwhelming some of your listeners with. But when you think that for 1,000 years, from basically the time of Jesus to about the time of the Norman conquest of England, basically from, you know, AD 1 to AD 1000, the world had about 300 million people. That's less than the population of the United States right now. And it now has 6.9 billion going to 7 billion. So it's increased by 18 or 20 times. There's not much doubt that had we managed to keep that population stability that we had, and nobody's quite sure how we were able to be so stable for those 1,000 years up until the year 1000, I have my own theories, but if for whatever reason we had somehow never grown beyond that, there's not much doubt that nobody would be talking about or thinking about human-induced climate change right now, even if there had been an industrial revolution, just because the numbers would be much smaller. They'd be so much smaller that you could divide everything by, you know, 18 or 20, and that would be the amount of greenhouse gases we're putting in the air. Maybe climate change would happen, but it would happen on very slow, almost the same sorts of scales that happens naturally on. So in that sense, you could say population has multiplied the human impact on the atmosphere by 20 times or more. On the other hand, the reality is that you can say something similar about the Industrial Revolution. Before the Industrial Revolution, we weren't digging coal, oil, and natural gas out of the crust of the earth. This is all carbon that was basically stored in the earth by living plants over hundreds of millions of years ago, and in just a few centuries were mining it as fast as we can and drilling it and bringing it up out of the crust and using it to power our cars and our homes and our buildings and our lives. So that has had its own effect almost independent of population. Really what it does is it combines with population growth. But scientists tend to look at four factors as affecting the rate of emissions of greenhouse gases. And population is usually the first one they mention. That's sort of the main foundation on which everything else is happening. And as it grows, you have more people emitting more greenhouse gases. The second one is, in fact, consumption or consumption growth, or it's often just called economic growth. And both of those really multiply each other. So you have a population that's been growing by a couple percent a year for most of the last couple centuries. And then you have an economy, a world economy that's been growing at a similar or in recent years even faster rate. And so the two of them multiply each other and emissions have been growing by 4 or 5%. And the two are additive. What's happened recently is two other factors that are frankly much smaller, but they're beginning to make themselves felt, are entering in the picture. One of them is how much of economic growth relates to energy. We have a service economy now more than we used to. So energy isn't quite as important to everything that we're doing economically to make ourselves comfortable. And then the other issue that's helpful is more energy in recent years has been derived from sources other than carbon, other than fossil fuels. Some of that's nuclear energy, a lot of it's hydropower, particularly in your part of the country, and then a lot of it is increasingly wind and solar power, geothermal, things of this kind. So as those two factors enter into the picture, a less energy-intensive economy and a less carbon-intensive energy system, then the multiplying effect of economic growth and population growth is diminished. But I have to say this, when you look at the figures, population really looms as the single most important factor, at least in my view. And the reason I say that is this, when you look at most countries' emissions growth over decades, it's extremely close to their population growth. There are some exceptions. China's emissions have grown way out of proportion to their population growth because they've had explosive economic growth over the last 10 or 20 years. But by and large, it tracks surprisingly closely. And it's not a surprise. Every new person is a person who's going to be driving or wanting to drive, certainly traveling, using fossil fuels, needing to cook, needing to heat. They may want air conditioning and they may be able to get it. All the things that cause climate change that relate very much to each of our individual lives. So population could hardly be more important than it is.
If reducing climate change is the goal, what level of population would be an ideal target for 2050 in your view?
That's a great question, and I'm not going to answer it. One thing about population is it's entirely been too associated with, well, literally the phrase I used earlier, but I don't ever use in a positive way, population control. We can't control population because we can't control people, and nor should we want to control people. We don't want to control parents. We don't want to tell women and men, you know, you should only have these many children. We can work to prevent unintended pregnancy, which has a positive impact on population. But this is a matter of a personal preference, but it's also a very common one in the population field. The whole question really needs to be based on human rights and human capacities and not on some kind of optimum population that we somehow determine in our wisdom is the right population to have. And that makes this more complicated. It'd be a lot easier for me to tell you and to try to educate policymakers, your listeners, journalists, and others by saying, you know, we have to stabilize the atmosphere, therefore we have to get to this particular population level by this particular date. And not being able to do that makes this whole argument more nuanced and a little bit more challenging to get across. The message I try to put across is we don't want to lose anybody that's here on Earth right now, at least before their natural time is up. Once you're on the earth, you're a human being with human rights, and you've got a right to be here, and you've got a right to live at least as comfortably as anybody else has a right to live. So you've got a right to make similar emissions, whether you're in sub-Saharan Africa or in New York City or San Francisco or Seattle or anywhere. So the issue really becomes, what approach do we take to climate, given that it is a human issue, a human problem, and it's about human beings and their lives? How can we optimize human well-being, optimize human capacities to make choices for themselves responsibly, but with as much freedom as possible for themselves to live the way they want to live, and yet still solve this really difficult question? And the way I like to look at it is basically that population growth couldn't diminish too much from the standpoint of having a better, more stable climate. It's not a bad thing if population stops growing, and if it actually starts declining, when we look at the positive impacts that's likely to have, not just on climate change, but in any number of environmental areas. So we need to think about, if that's the case, what are the circumstances and the conditions under which we would like to see populations stop growing and eventually start declining? And to me, that's a fairly easy question to answer. It needs to be based entirely on the birth rates that result from wanted pregnancies. I think that we clearly don't want death rates to be going up. We don't want governments to be telling women how many children they can have. What we want is that the collective outcome of women and their partners being able to make decisions for themselves about how many children they will have results in healthy children being born and surviving, and yet still in a lower birth rate than we have now. And the good news about this, and this is actually the area where I'm pushing my own research right as we speak, is that there's good data that is beginning to really document the demographic power that intended pregnancy has. There is so much unintended pregnancy in the world, literally in the neighborhood of 40 to 45, maybe even closer to 50%. Almost half of pregnancies that occur are what I like to call whoops pregnancies instead of yay pregnancies. And I'm not a woman, but I've known quite a few of them, and I think most women know the difference, although there may be some gray areas in the middle. But generally, you know, you either really actively want to become a parent and seek a pregnancy, whether you're a woman or a man, or it's kind of the outcome of something else you're seeking, which might be sex, but it wasn't the outcome you were hoping would happen. And as we optimize the intentionality of childbearing, what we find is that the number of births, frankly, goes down significantly. And since we already have a much smaller family, as I mentioned earlier, average family size in the world than we did 40 or 50 years ago, as births resulting from unintended pregnancies are reduced, that number goes down, then the average family size becomes even smaller. So to me, that's really what optimum population size is. What I like to say is the right population is the population that results from keeping death rates low, life expectancy high, and even maybe improving both of those, and yet having the births that result from intentional parenting, from couples' active decisions to take care of a child and to nurture her or him until she or he makes it to their own adulthood and makes the same decisions for themselves. On the numbers side, I think we could easily have population peaking not much more than 8 billion under good circumstances. If my theories are right about this, rather than going to 9 billion and still growing at the middle of the century, I think we could have 8 billion and beginning to shrink totally on voluntary, on the idea of this is based on women's own decision-making with their partners, and that would be a very positive benefit for the climate.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Robert Engelman, Vice President for Programs at World Watch Institute and author of the World Watch Report, Population, Climate Change, and Women's Lives. To what extent is population being considered in discussions of climate change?
The easy answer to that is very little. It's just really too sensitive to bring into the high-level discussions that the country governments get involved in through the United Nations that your listeners will have heard of in Copenhagen and just back in December in Cancun. It's hard enough to figure out what you can do in terms of making commitments to reduce your emissions or at least slow the growth of emissions or stabilize emissions or whatever, without bringing in the question of, well, how many people are you going to have? NGOs or, you know, non-governmental organizations and a lot of the activists around climate change do sometimes have discussions around this. There's great interest in the public. I find a lot of interest in the public when I speak on this. And journalists are getting very interested. A lot of articles have run in newspapers and on the radio, television even, about how population relates to climate change. But it is still a sensitive enough topic that the few attempts that have been made to bring it to the level of discussions of nations negotiating among themselves as to how to address this problem have not gone very far at all.
You've been alluding to this, but what would be your recommendation for a program to slow population growth worldwide? What is most likely to work?
Well, this is the part that I would like to bring into the conversation about climate, because I think it would not be nearly as sensitive or difficult or controversial as a lot of people believe, because it just isn't well known. But back in 1994, all the governments of the world, bar almost none, met in Cairo in Egypt, a city that's been much in the news lately for other reasons, to have a UN-sponsored conference on population and development. And they came to a historic understanding that has just still not really been noticed by much of the rest of the world, even though the conference got some news coverage when it occurred. A program of action essentially to address human population through development and human rights. And this is basically the strategy that I have been promoting ever since that time and writing about, and is really in many ways the focus of my book, More, Population, Nature, and What Women Want. And the What Women Want aspect is the key thing. It's sort of a provocative part of the subtitle, obviously, particularly for a book written by a man. But it's serious. And what women want, and this is what this conference really understood well, was what men don't have to ask for, which is the capacity to be sexual beings without necessarily becoming pregnant and giving birth when it isn't the right time to do that for the person involved. So this means that we need population policies around the world that are oriented toward women's empowerment over their productive lives and their reproductive lives. I mean, there are many, many other reasons that have absolutely nothing to do, and I want to stress this, with population, that we should be making sure that women stand literally shoulder to shoulder with men in every aspect of economic, political, civic, social, and even personal life. And I always want to be careful when I talk about these things to not sound as though the whole reason to give women equal rights is so that they'll have fewer babies. But it happens to be a positive outcome of women achieving equal or near equal status, as close to equal as we can make it, with men in societies. And the particular aspect of it that I tend to focus on, because it sometimes does get overlooked, is the absolute urgency of making sure that women can protect themselves from unwanted pregnancy as well as sexually transmitted disease and other aspects of reproductive ill health. But if women can't get access, and I stress women because they are the ones who give birth, 100% of them last time I checked the data, and they are the ones that undergo all the risks of pregnancy and childbirth. It isn't to say that men aren't involved and men don't have a responsibility. I mean, it's critical that men have access to these services and men have access to sexuality education as well, particularly because women so often are the victims of male ignorance and male ill will in regard to these areas. But it's just essential that both men and women have access to services that enable them to become intentional parents when they want to give birth to a child. And if we really could have conditions that met that high standard around the world, then it wouldn't be terribly expensive and terribly difficult to do. It really is an issue of political will and public will more than anything else. I think that would be all the real population policy we'd need. Now, some people can bring up immigration, and well, they should. This gets complicated when you talk about borders and people moving across borders, and I confess my aspect of this work doesn't get as intimately involved in that question, although I think it's a very legitimate one. So you still have questions about who's moving where. But frankly, if you achieved a population, a world population that peaked and actually began to decline, the pressures for immigration itself, or emigration, migration generally, would be reduced considerably as people found that their labor was needed in their own countries and housing was less expensive and congestion was less bad and probably less conflict for that matter. That's a whole other issue, but one that enters into this picture. It would be easier not to have to move. So to me, it's a population policy that is based on rights. It's based on health and education and well-being, and particularly women's well-being and their empowerment. And it makes all the sense in the world, and while it doesn't solve our environmental problems, it certainly makes them much easier to solve by operating directly on the problems themselves. And it just sets us up for long-term environmental sustainability and social sustainability and justice. To me, it makes all the sense in the world, and I'm just hoping that other people can be brought to see the wisdom of it.
How cost-effective are efforts to reduce population growth likely to be compared to other climate mitigation strategies?
This is another question that I'm always a little hesitant to answer, in part because the numbers are so powerful. There's a danger of not so much overstating them, but stating them accurately, but sounding like you're saying that, you know, we don't have to build windmills or we don't have to do anything else. Because There have been studies that look at what would it cost to reduce future greenhouse gas emissions through provision of, for example, girls' education, which has a powerful effect on reducing fertility and making family size smaller around the world, and basically through reducing unintended pregnancies and lowering desired family size. And, of course, family planning. Both girls' education and provision of good family planning services are not terrifically expensive. And when you calculate them out over several generations of smaller families, the reduced emissions are, frankly, much higher than when you think about replacing coal-fired plants with nuclear plants, or changing all cars to electric cars that are powered by solar panels, or whatever you want to do. And I'm not saying, and this is the sensitive part, I'm not saying you don't do those things, because you got to do those things. And they operate on somewhat different timescales. With population, it's sort of a long-term but very large effect. With the solar panels and windmills, it's sort of less effect over the longer term, but it has an immediate hit. And we certainly need both at this point. Climate change is a long-term problem that is extremely urgent in the short term and needs to be acted on right now. So what I always recommend is you do all of the above. There's no reason to pit different solutions against each other and say, let's do this and not that. But it doesn't cost much more than $20 to $50 for an individual person around the world to protect them from unintended pregnancy for a year. So that's, you know, every year maybe $20 to $50 or so. And so that sounds like, well, there's a lot of women in the world who have reproductive age. That's probably hundreds of millions, maybe a few billion dollars. But then you compare that to the $500 million that we spend annually just in the United States fighting two wars, for example, and not that they're easily comparable. But frankly, the dollars are just not all that significant. It's really the lack of political will rather than the lack of money. And it's multiplied in so many ways, because not only does slower population growth improve the picture for climate change, it improves the picture for food insecurity, for energy, high energy prices, for high housing prices, for low labor prices. One of the reasons the wages you and I and others get are not higher is that there's so many people trying to find jobs. There's so many benefits to slower population growth that you almost can't compare the numbers that it would cost to just enable women to really have the children that they actually desire to have compared to the problems that are exacerbated by rapidly growing populations.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
This is a win-win situation. I know that's a cliche. I guess people are always talking about win-win situations. But the things that I'm suggesting that could be done to improve the world's population picture and position us for environmental sustainability and social justice around the world are the things that we should be doing anyway, because it's wrong when unintended pregnancy is imposed on women. It's wrong when women die in childbirth. It's wrong when babies don't survive their birth or don't survive the first year. These things tend to be seen as soft issues rather than hard issues, but they're very hard. They're very, very critical, urgent issues for all the things that we worry about and spend lots of money on, whether it's conflict, whether it's public health, whether it's feeding people, which is becoming a really big issue these days. And if we focused on creating a world of health and of choices for women and men as they enter their years of reproduction and facing the possibility of being parents, and we focus on that, we don't even really need to focus on population. We don't need to have the discussion that much, though I think it's always a plus. But population will benefit from the commitments we make to invest in the health and the well-being of women to make choices about their lives. And if you're an environmentalist, if you're a social activist, if you're for justice, you ought to be making this issue your own.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Robert.
Thank you very much, Diane. It's my pleasure.
You have just been listening to Robert Engelman, Vice President for Research at World Watch Institute and author of the World Watch Report, Population, Climate Change, and Women's Lives, published in 2010. For more information, check on the web at www.worldwatch.org/population-climate-women. Again, that's worldwatch.org/population-climate-women. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM nkexp.org.